How did an intellectual with roots in pre-war Poland become one of the leading elite manipulators of global politics? What were the key innovations brought forward by Brzezinski to the benefit and detriment of U.S. primacy? How did Brzezinski's perspectives on world governance evolve over the course of the post-war on terror era? What legacy did Carter's former national security advisor leave behind? On this week's Global Research News Hour, on the occasion of the death of one of the world's leading and most notorious globalist thinkers, we focus on that individual's record and writings and how they have shaped the modern era of international politics. We'll hear perspectives from writer and commentator Jay Dyer of 21st Century Wire. We'll hear from Moscow-based correspondent and former White House staffer under President Carter, John Helmer. We'll hear excerpts from an interview with geopolitical analyst Andrew Korybko. And we'll hear an analysis from Filip Kovacevic, University of San Francisco-based professor and senior analyst with Newsbud.com. On this week's program, Death of the Grand Chessmaster, the Bloody Legacy of Zbigniew Brzezinski. Bringing you the analysis beyond the media headlines, the Global Research News Hour is on the air. Welcome to the Global Research News Hour for the week of June 2nd, 2017. I'm series host, creator, and producer Michael Welch. The Global Research News Hour is a special radio collaboration between the Center for Research on Globalization and Campus Community Radio Station, CKUW 95.9 FM in Winnipeg, on occupied Anishinaabe territory on the homeland of the Métis Nation. We seek to provide you with access to analysis of the major issues shaping our world today, from thinkers, researchers, and unique political personalities rarely addressed by major media. Our program is available from the Center's website, globalresearch.ca. We can also be heard on the Progressive Radio Network at prn.fm. We'll begin our show with News Notes, a sampling of articles from the Global Research News site. Was Wednesday's blast a terrorist incident like many others in U.S. war theaters? Or was it something else, unknown at this time, perhaps to get Trump to authorize sending thousands more U.S. combat troops to Afghanistan? Obama continued Bush-Cheney's war after pledging to end it. Now it's Trump's. Will he continue the futility of the past 16 years, America's longest war, sending more U.S. forces to pursue a lost cause? That comes from the article, War and Terrorism, What's Behind the Massive Kabul Blast? ISIS Claimed Responsibility, by Stephen Lendman, posted June 1st. As Fallujah, near destroyed by the U.S. in 2004, was known as City of Mosques, Mosul has been known as City of Churches. The population, however, has been richly diverse. Arabs, Assyrians, Armenians, Turkmens, Kurds, Yazidis, Shabakis, Mandaeans, Qalia, Circassians. Sunni Islam has been the largest religion, but Salafism, Christianity, Shia Islam, Sufism, Yazidism, Shabakism, Hayarsan, and Mandaeanism all coexisted in and around this ancient, hauntingly beautiful city. Mosul, as so much of Iraq, has suffered unimaginably under ISIS, but it is hard to spot the difference from how Iraq suffered under the US and UK and are again. The US bombed the city during the 2003 invasion, murdered Saddam Hussein's two sons and 15-year-old grandson there in July 2003. No judge or jury, just US ISIS-style summary executions as across the nation. That comes from the article, The Quote-Unquote Liberation of Mosul, Another Fallujah, Dresden, or Hiroshima, by Felicity Arbuthnot, posted June 1st. As with many of her previous documents, Mason outlines how Monsanto has conspired to keep its money-spinning, disease-causing product, glyphosate-based Roundup, on the market via a combination of deception, the manipulation of science and regulatory processes, and the co-option of key figures, the same company that was also involved in the cover-up of polychlorinated biphenyls, or PCBs. Mason states, quote, Wales is the site of the worst environmental disaster that the public has never heard of because there was a massive cover-up for more than 40 years, unquote. She describes the role of the British government in colluding with Monsanto by outlining how Monsanto poisoned the environment in Wales with the dumping of toxins from its factory there, where it manufactured PCBs, and other dangerous chemicals. The company knew about the health risks of PCBs long before they were banned. That comes from the article, Toxic Relations: Stop Colluding with Monsanto and the Agrochemical Industry, by Rosemary Mason and Colin Todd Hunter, posted June 1st. The professional sports individual is tasked with endurance and performance as a sole domain, and opinions, notably of a political or sexual kind, would tend to be private matters. Often they would best remain that way. Not so Margaret Court, one of the most successful tennis players of all time, who forgot herself when she decided that her opinions seemed to be the stuff of gold, valued because she had done something with the ball and racket. Her mouth was loosened by the stance taken by the Australian airliner Qantas that it would support same-sex marriage. Quote, "I am disappointed," she fumed, "that Qantas has become an active promoter for same-sex marriage," unquote. That comes from the article Tennis Player Margaret Court and Same-Sex Woes by Dr. Binoy Campmark, posted May 31st. The problem with cryptocurrencies is that whereas Bitcoin cannot increase in supply, other cryptocurrencies can be created. In order to be trusted, each cryptocurrency would have to have a limited supply. However, an endless number of cryptocurrencies could be created that would greatly increase the supply of cryptocurrencies. If entrepreneurs don't bring about this result, the Federal Reserve itself could organize it. Therefore, cryptocurrency might be only a temporary refuge from fiat money creation. That comes from the article, Is Bitcoin Standing in for Gold? By Dr. Paul Craig Roberts and Dave Kranzler, posted May 31st, originally appearing at paulcraigroberts.org. These are just a few of the featured articles appearing last week on the Global Research website. Regular visitors to the site are encouraged to send monetary contributions by fax, mail, or online. Just go to globalresearch.ca and click Donate on the menu bar. On Friday, May 26th, Zbigniew Brzezinski was reported to have died in a Falls Church, Virginia hospital at the age of 89. Zbigniew Brzezinski was the son of a Polish diplomat. He was born and raised in Warsaw. When he was 10, his father was relocated to Montreal, where he served as consul general for Poland just before the German-Soviet non-aggression pact was signed and the invasion of Poland took place. Brzezinski studied at McGill University, where he obtained bachelor and master's degrees, his master's thesis being concerned with nationalities within the Soviet Union. Frustrated in his ambitions to pursue further studies in the United Kingdom, he moved to the United States and attended Harvard. Brzezinski was perhaps best known for his involvement in the Carter administration pushing for a military solution to the Iran hostage crisis, and notably for his support of the Mujahideen militias, which drew the Soviets into Afghanistan and tapped their resources, leading to the collapse of the USSR. But Brzezinski had a much more prominent role on the world stage than that. Zbig, as he's been called by friends and detractors alike, was a major mover and shaker in the halls of power. He was a regular participant of the infamous and secretive Bilderberg and Council on Foreign Relations groups. Importantly, he co-founded, with David Rockefeller, the Trilateral Commission. All these elite groupings seek to thwart the abilities of peoples around the world to govern in their own interest, leaving them beholden to the ambitions of big-moneyed interests who mingle behind closed doors with political leaders around the world. Brzezinski was also a significant intellectual force whose influential published works included Between Two Ages, America's Role in the Technotronic Era from 1970, Game Plan, a Geostrategic Framework for the Conduct of the U.S.-Soviet Contest from 1986, The Grand Chessboard, American Primacy and Its Geostrategic Imperatives from 1997, and Strategic Vision, America and the Crisis of Global Power from 2012. Brzezinski's ideas made their mark on both wings of elite power in the United States. To get a sense of the profundity of his impact and of the experiences that helped shape his approach, I brought in an observer well-versed in Brzezinski's writings. Jay Dyer is a writer and media commentator. His graduate work focused on the interplay between film, geopolitics, espionage, and psychological warfare. He's also the author of Esoteric Hollywood, Sex, Cults, and Symbols in Film. He's a regular contributor to 21st Century Wire and has a website, jaysanalysis.com. He has researched Mr. Zbigniew Brzezinski quite extensively. We welcome him to our show. Good morning, Jay Dyer.
Hello, Michael. Pleasure to be here. Thank you for having me. And it's an interesting year. We've seen the passing of both David Rockefeller and Brzezinski.
Indeed, within months of each other, both the co-founders of the Trilateral Commission are dead. And I know I've heard you comment on Mr. Brzezinski before. I'm just wondering, what thoughts you've had in the last week on the occasion of his passing.
Well, he, I believe, was in some way more or less spotted by David Rockefeller, and probably the publication of Between Two Ages caught the attention of the oligarchs. And I think because of its future predictive capacities, you know, this was written back in the 70s, early 70s off the top of my head. And in that book, he describes a more or less a managerial technocratic future. Now, that is perfectly in line with someone who in many ways is very similar, Dr. Carol Quigley, who wrote the famous book Tragedy and Hope, as well as many other military histories and history of the Anglo-American establishment. And I've done a lot of research into Dr. Quigley's works as well. And there's an important chapter in Quigley's book towards the middle where he outlines what he sees happening in the next several decades. Now, this book was written back in the 60s. And what Dr. Quigley says is that we can look forward to a technocratic managerial bureaucracy that will probably at least attempt to be global. So what I see Brzezinski as is a kind of successor to that ideology. He comes onto the scene from Canada. Interestingly, he was an immigrant, and as a result of the Russian situation and the Soviet situation in Poland, this sparked a very intense and very well known dislike for anything Russian or Soviet on the part of Brzezinski. And from that point on, he went to McGill University. Which is interesting. I don't mean to get too conspiratorial here, but it is, I think, relevant when we consider Between Two Ages. McGill University was very important in the many universities that participated in the MKUltra program. Now, I'm not saying anything ridiculous like that Brzezinski was himself some sort of subject. No, rather, on the contrary, I believe that the MKUltra programs were more so about social engineering. In terms of mass consciousness, particularly through things like mass media, marketing, advertising, and all of that tied into all of the psychiatric institutions and universities that were involved in studying these various sub-projects related to mind control. Mm-hmm. Now, Brzezinski will reference that actually in several places in Between Two Ages, not MKUltra, but he'll reference that very subject matter, the possibility of technocratic governments using all these means of control, technocratic expansion across the globe, then, and particularly the internet. The book is very has a lot of foresight because he foresaw that we would even have things like universities being online, basically. And he foresaw this back in the 70s. So yeah. I think he it's not a totally negative book in that he doesn't project a future of doom. I mean, he has a kind of liberal cover in a way. And I think that that's why you see him in the background of Democratic administrations like Carter and Obama. And now, again, there's a lot more that could be said. We can definitely go into more quotes from Between Two Ages. But that's where he comes onto the scene, is really as this kind of a background advisor and university professor and just sort of higher level geopolitical graduate. You know, I think the department was something to do with advanced international studies, I think, was the department that he headed up. So in a way, he's a kind of foil to Kissinger. They're very similar in many ways, with Brzezinski kind of playing a little more to the left side, a little less hawkish and more of a fan of the incremental kind of approach to erecting a new, quote, world order, which he uses that term many times. So this is very much a Brzezinski idea. As is the technocracy, the bureaucracy, the managerial government of the future.
Interesting. I know he's most popularly known for his role with the Jimmy Carter administration as national security advisor, but I'm interested in pursuing a little bit more that behind-the-scenes role he played with these elite entities, the Bilderberg Council of Council on Foreign Relations, and most notably his co-founding in the early 70s alongside David Rockefeller of the Trilateral Commission. In fact, he was the director of the Trilateral Commission from the time of its founding.
The first director, exactly.
You know, right to the election of Jimmy Carter. So could you comment? I mean, was it simply that Rockefeller connection that brought him into this elite realm, or were there other factors involved?
I think that, you know, obviously he showed, like I said, a lot of proficiency academically and in terms of scholarship. But if you go with the thesis, which I think is most likely, there's a good book by Servando Gonzalez about psychological warfare in the New World Order. And he talks about the process of how the CFR, which of course preceded the Trilateral Commission, how they would actually choose future presidents and candidates and what some people call the brains of the New World Order. So you might have the bankers and the bloods. The nobility, the blue blood, so to speak, and you also have the brains, and these are the people who are kind of the Machiavellian figures. If you've read Art of War by Machiavelli or The Prince, then you know that he was this sort of background advisor, quote unquote, who probably had a lot more power than the puppet princes. And in the same way, I think that Brzezinski is a kind of a brain character who was chosen and put in that role because of his abilities, and I think that is most exemplified by the example of Carter, because, you know, Carter was very unknown, and then you see him, this peanut farmer, you see him go to the Bilderberg meeting, and you know, he's in with the Trilateral crowd, and then what do you know? Not too long after that, he becomes president. And I think that was very much probably the workings of Brzezinski. So that's my take on it. But, you know, you may have more light to shed on his actual personal maneuvers. I'm mainly familiar with the works.
Mm-hmm. Well, I know it's interesting that he's like not just Mr. Carter, but Walter Mondale and mm-hmm. Cyrus Vance and mm-hmm. you know, so many figures within that administration ended up you know, having those connections with the Trilateral Commission and Bilderberg and so on. So I'm just wondering how much of a game changer the Trilateral Commission in particular was in determining the policies of the Carter administration and Brzezinski himself and his ability to be influential in U.S. and world affairs.
I would say very influential, because, you know, depending on how you view the power of presidents, I don't view them as that much of a force, precisely because they are, I would say, chosen and groomed for these roles. And that's not just the thesis of Servando Gonzalez. It's also the thesis of Dr. Carol Quigley as well in Tragedy and Hope, where he talks about elections not really being anything of much substance for the last 100 years, more or less. And you really have that because of the banking power and the combines and financial capitalism and monopoly capitalism and all the things that he lists in Tragedy and Hope. But I would also say that the clearest example of this would be, the determinations of foreign policy, especially in 1978, 79 with Robert Gates and with Hamid Ghul and different figures from the Pakistani ISI working with the CIA under the direction of Brzezinski to already, which if you read Golden Fitzgerald's book, Invisible History, the CIA was in Afghanistan back into the late 60s and 70s through the universities, actually already grooming young guys for the preparation of the introduction of the Mujahideen. So this was actually a long-term plan where the CIA would switch out of supporting Arab nationalism and move into the support of the more Wahhabist, radical Taliban, Mujahideen, et cetera, et cetera. And so and it's really Brzezinski that is the mastermind of that. I think most people are a lot of people are aware of that now because, you know, Brzezinski's given public interviews where he actually talked about it. This has gone around, the web for many years. So that, I would say, suggests to me that he was the real, at least, brains behind the throne. I don't think Jimmy Carter was the one, really making the decisions about what would happen in the 1979 Iran hostage crisis or the usage, co-opting of the Mujahideen.
And that whole template of utilizing this, you made reference to the sort of psychological operations before, these sort of ethnic divisions, that was a large part of his approach to dealing with the Soviet Union by building on those identities. And that correct. Seems to – that approach seems to have survived to the present moment. What's your take on the way that template has kind of been molded over the years?
Oh, I think you're spot on there. In fact, you can go back to Between Two Ages, and in that book, Brzezinski discusses what would eventually become the technology of soft power or the usage of NGOs, think tanks who could agitprop and use agitation propaganda and different methods in countries to exacerbate existing political, religious, racial divisions and create chaos, essentially. And that is what he says in the book. He says you can utilize destabilization and chaos as a technology, and it doesn't always have to be through military means. And so being of that more technocratic bent and frame of mind, from the outset back in Between Two Ages, Brzezinski is really signaling what would become the dominant modus operandi of the change in foreign policy out of, and this is, I think, where he differs with the neocons. I think that the neoconservatives have the same end game with somebody who might be of a little more of a left bent like Brzezinski. But the means by which we get to that end goal differ, and Brzezinski definitely favors soft power and the usage of. Now, I'm not saying that the Taliban or Mujahideen were necessarily soft power, but he was saying back in the 70s that you could use what would become soft power, mm-hmm. I really think that that's what we see in all these problem regions today. And in fact, if you look at what he said in Grand Chessboard back in 1997, he signaled way ahead of time what would happen in Ukraine. And, Brzezinski was spot on. So what happened in 2014 is exactly what he said, needed to happen in Grand Chessboard to control the Eurasian landmass, which is the axis in the Heartland Theory view of the world.
Would it be a stretch to say he's kind of like the godfather of the National Endowment of Democracy and and the USAID and those sorts of NGOs that have been going
out? I didn't think about that. That's a great way to put it. I was thinking of Machiavelli behind the throne of the prince, but maybe the godfather is a little more. There was a guy, Dr. Koppel, I believe his name is, a German statesman, and back in the 90s he wrote a PhD thesis on NATO, and he eventually became a big critic of Brzezinski and kind of had a falling out. And that's how he described it. He said it's a Godfather crime syndicate. So I think you're spot on.
Okay, so I guess that just leaves me with my final question. What do you think his legacy moving forward? I mean, looking where we're at now with the current state of affairs, Trump in the White House, and what we're seeing with Russia and China seeming to come together. What do you think his legacy will be in terms of moving forward?
Well, he favored much tighter relations with China, obviously, than Russia. He always saw Russia as the chief opponent and threat to the Anglo-American establishment, which jibes very well with the history of British imperialism. And I think that the American model, especially after the invasion of a lot of the British intelligence agents into American foreign policy with Ian Fleming and Noel Coward and those different characters who actually helped Bill Donovan set up the OSS, which will become the CIA. That shift towards the rapprochement with British foreign policy would eventually become the present state of affairs of the Anglo-American establishment, and that's why you have the support for radical Islam, which was the old British imperial model. Saudi Arabia, et cetera, et cetera. So I think that Brzezinski's legacy is very much as a proponent of that liberal American Anglo world order and the imperative, so they believe, to spread this model to the entire globe. So, when we see the chaos and the destabilization of other countries, when we have the ideology of the fake human rights ideology, which is what masquerades as the supposed basis for going into all these countries and toppling leaders and so forth. And what we're seeing in Syria now is a great example. I mean, that's really just an extension of what we saw in Ukraine in 2014. It's the same technology and techniques of soft power to remove the existing elected leaders who are very popular. Assad's very popular. And to replace them with something, along the lines of Wahhabism or Salafism, ISIS, all this kind of stuff. That's his legacy. His legacy is controlled chaos, which he says even in his last book, Strategic Vision, he's still talking about Manichaean dialectics and managing those dialectics. So, I don't think we've seen any change. In fact, I think we've seen the adoption of the Brzezinski model over the more war hawk neocon model of a Bush or a Cheney or these kind of characters. And I think that Trump might be more on the side of the Bush type of approach to things. But regardless, the modus operandi, it looks like it's going to be the technocracy, and we need to look no further than the drone warfare, the mass surveillance, the NSA. That's more in line with the Brzezinski model of soft power than the possibility of troops on the ground everywhere. I'm not saying that there won't be troops on the ground and there won't be future giant wars. Obviously, there probably will be regional conflicts and whatnot. But we're definitely living in the between two ages description there. So it's almost like an H.G. Wells novel if you read Between Two Ages.
Okay. Well, I want to thank you very much for your perspectives, Jay. It's been a pleasure speaking with you.
Absolutely. Thank you.
We've been speaking with Jay Dyer, a writer, commentator, and contributor to 21st Century Wire. Jay Dyer is the author of Esoteric Hollywood, Sex, Cults, and Symbols in Film. To purchase a signed copy of the book, you can place an order directly by visiting his website, jaysanalysis.com, and clicking on the link, Purchase Signed Copy of Esoteric Hollywood Book Here, on the menu bar. You're listening to the Global Research News Hour, broadcast out of Winnipeg on campus community radio station CKUW 95.9 FM and on the Progressive Radio Network at prn.fm. We are also podcast on the website globalresearch.ca. In October of 2016, I had a chance to interview geopolitical analyst Andrew Korbko. In a comprehensive conversation on hybrid warfare, he mentioned Brzezinski's name and how the strategies of hybrid war were influenced in part by Brzezinski's theories.
The idea that Brzezinski had, based off of his research in the 1970s before he created the Mujahideen with Jimmy Carter, was to use the Islamic factor and to use kind of this clash of civilizations idea to just splinter the whole thing up, basically divide it all up, and through this chaos, this creative chaos, if you will, that will create enough problems to keep Eurasia divided. Now, what's interesting is actually talks about, you know, dividing this up and everything in the clash of civilizations. He doesn't talk about that, but at the same time, that's where Samuel Huntington came out with his idea. Why this is so important, Michael, is many people took the clash of civilizations to be a warning. The way I see it, it wasn't a warning. It was a blueprint for how the U.S. would implement the Eurasian Balkans and the Wolfowitz Doctrine in dividing and ruling the entire Eastern Hemisphere. And we see that George Bush, with the invasion of Iraq, the war on Iraq in 2003, and Afghanistan in 2001, these two states were already predetermined targets. I mean, there's existing publicly available literature from Project for a New American Century and other neoconservative outlets that pinpoint these countries as targets because of what they geostrategically represent. Yes, there was energy as a factor. On the other hand, there was also the idea of an American presence in these very strategic regions. Iraq's in the middle of the Mideast. Afghanistan is in a tri-regional pivot space. Central Asia, West Asia, otherwise known as the Mideast, and South Asia. The long story short is using these identity conflicts that the region is already predisposed to, the United States sought to keep Russia, China, and Iran separated through this controlled chaos, if you will. But as we see, though, when you open the Pandora's box, it doesn't always go the way that you want. When the U.S. engineered the Euromaidan urban terrorist coup in Ukraine, also rural terrorism involved as well in the western reaches, taking over military facilities, police stations, so on and so forth, was barely reported except for once or twice in Newsweek magazine. But, and forget that, who would have thought that Crimea would have reunified with Russia? Who would have thought that the chaos the U.S. unleashed in Syria would result in Russian anti-terrorist operations?
If you can't co-opt them in some way, and that's going to be very difficult. You just generate a lot of chaos, or else put some kind of brutal regime in place that's going to subdue the people. And so it's interesting to reflect on this idea of how that vision may be evolving, and how much these human dynamics, psychological dynamics, are coming into play as these strategists are putting forth their operations, their military campaigns, with a huge emphasis on the psychological development dimension.
Yeah, I mean, if you're going to look at the personal psychological development, and, you know, if you want to focus on Brzezinski, I mean, we can't get away from the fact that he is an asshole from Poland. Why this is important is it means that he was, sometime throughout his life, he was exposed to the ideas of Piłsudski. Piłsudski was an interwar Polish leader. Some people herald him as the father of Poland after World War I. Many Polish patriots, they adore him. But why I'm bringing him up is because he had this innovative strategy called Prometheism. And this idea was really the main antecedent of the Eurasian Balkans and everything else, because if we accept that Brzezinski is the main innovator of this creative chaos Eurasian Balkans theorem, and we trace his heritage to around this time with Piłsudski. Obviously, Brzezinski is very well aware of international relations, literature, thought. He's a very proud Pole. I mean, he knows about Piłsudski. Piłsudski's idea was this, Michael. His idea was you have the Soviet Union. It is a very identity-diverse state, many religions, ethnicities, history, all these hybrid war vulnerabilities that you read out in the introduction are present in the Soviet Union. So what Piłsudski's Poland wanted to do was exploit these by making these types of unholy alliances, for example, with Ukrainians, Georgians, trying to send out feelers to Chechens, things like this, to see how far they can go in undermining the identity unity or the patriotism of the Soviet Union. Now, they didn't succeed. Actually, everything had failed. and the idea is seen as actually being a failure by most. However, I take a radically different interpretation. I say that it was very far ahead of its time in the sense of looking at the Soviet Union's vulnerabilities that could in turn be transplanted to any other strategic identity diverse state, as Brzezinski did. If we trace Brzezinski's published literature back, we see that in the late 1970s, I think it was 1978 or so, he came up with a construction called the Arc of Chaos. This is very important in the modern day because he basically says the entire Indian Ocean arc, because of, he focuses on the Islamic factor, but it could be many other factors as well, but we can concentrate on the Islamic factor. Because of that, it's very vulnerable to destabilization, particularly an outside state. In this case, he suspected it would be the Soviet Union. I think in this case, he was kind of mirroring what the U.S. would do in the future. He said the Soviet Union could exploit this factor to incite communist rebellions and so on and so forth. What actually had happened, though, is we see that he was already looking at weaponizing the religious factor. I mean, he was focusing on weaponizing Islam. He did this in 1979 when he openly admitted to funding and creating the Taliban with Jimmy Carter, who ironically, for some reason or another, is identified with peace, which is such a lie for many reasons, including this one, in order to incite the Soviet anti-terrorist intervention in Afghanistan.
John Helmer is a foreign correspondent based in Moscow and a past guest of this program. In the late 1970s, however, he was a member of the White House staff under President Jimmy Carter. He and another staffer, a U.S. Air Force officer named Len Vernamonte, had been tasked early in Carter's presidency with something called the Presidential Reorganization Project. This project was intended as an evaluation of the president's decision-making apparatus. But as Helmer explains, the commentary with regard to Zbigniew Brzezinski's advisory role was frowned on by Brzezinski himself.
We weren't theoreticians and we weren't ideologues. We were simply reviewing the decision that the president had reached on matters for which Mr. Brzezinski was responsible, and analyzing the way in which he had, and these are the key conclusions, he falsified the choices, he misrepresented the evidence, he suppressed difference of view within the U.S. government, he manipulated, distorted, and let's say prejudiced the president's decision-making on key issues. Okay, and he wasn't the only one, but he was a very powerful one, and he didn't like the conclusions. So, as he had the right, as everyone had the right in that process, to read the case study and then challenge and argue the merits of the findings and of the conclusions and of the recommendations that were about to go to the president, Brzezinski fought fiercely. And he fought it the normal way, if you were in his position, by trying to kill the presentation so the president would never hear it. So the order came down to us, the staff men, from our boss, then Harrison Welford, that on the eve of going into the White House to meet with Carter and present the report, we were to stay stum. We were not permitted to answer questions that would cast Brzezinski or his decision-making role, advisory role, in a negative light. The recommendation to dismantle the elaborate bureaucracy he was running was never presented to Carter. And that's how it was done. And we were told that if we tried to put it to Carter at our meeting, we'd be fired. And so that was the choice facing my colleague from the U.S. Air Force and myself. And the meeting then proceeded the following week with the president. An interesting meeting it was. And Carter was very grateful, he said, for the report, for the originality of the report. He said he would read it. I don't believe he did, but if he did, he didn't act on it.
I'm wondering if you have any insights or explanation as to what was behind Mr. Carter's dedication to Mr. Brzezinski, and especially in light of all of the other murmurs out there about, you know, like Vance's widow and others who didn't seem to think very highly of Mr. Brzezinski.
My conclusion was nobody read as carefully and as voluminously as Carter. So he really tried. He had a passion to master a topic intellectually. On the other hand, in my view, he had an inferiority complex. He needed to not only master himself what the brief was, he needed to intellectually dominate the source or anyone he thought might compete with his brain to determine what the best course of action was. He needed Brzezinski to assure him that the cleverest brain Carter knew was subordinate to Carter's brain. And Brzezinski was an intellectual courtier of some cleverness. He flattered Carter. He fawned on Carter. He convinced Carter that Brzezinski's Eastern European Polish origins, his level of education, his professorial rank, etc., etc., all of that convinced Carter that Brzezinski understood the world, the method of applying brain to facts and evidence in the world, and devised policy, both strategy and tactics. That was spellbinding for Carter, and nobody else had that quality. I made some discoveries over the years since then that I had no idea of at the time. I've tried to put them together in a piece today. The key theme that comes out that I've tried to highlight in the report today is that Carter and Brzezinski agreed on black operations everywhere in the world to combat what they saw, what Brzezinski in particular saw as the aggressive expansionist policies of the then Soviet Union, of the Kremlin. And Brzezinski engaged in his lifelong career of war fighting against Russians, persuaded Carter in secret that these were operations that were unique, that would be successful, and would change the world strategically. Brzezinski's advice was mad, obsessive, and has resulted in a great many failures and disasters for which we currently are unable to deal with or live with. It was Brzezinski who started the U.S. arming and financing of Islamic terrorism and fundamentalism in Afghanistan as a tool against the Soviets. And that's metamorphosed, as you all know, today into ISIS, Al-Qaeda, and the kind of threat from Islamic religious fanaticism that affects the whole world and will for the rest of our lifetimes, the rest of the foreseeable future. That's a Carter Brzezinski achievement, and Carter's the last man alive to admit he ever made such a mistake.
For more on Mr. Helmer's assessment of Brzezinski in the Carter years, please find his two recent articles at the site johnhelmer.net. and on the Mirror sites, johnhelmer.online and johnhelmer.org. Professor Filip Kovacevic is Montenegrin geopolitical author, university professor, and the chairman of the Movement for Neutrality of Montenegro. He is the author of 7 books and dozens of academic articles. He teaches at the University of San Francisco and functions as senior analyst for Russia and the Balkans for Newsbud.com. Welcome to the Global Research News Hour, Professor.
Thank you very much for inviting me.
Now, In the grand chessboard, Mr. Brzezinski promoted U.S. hegemony and dominance in Eurasia. It seems, though, that in recent years his emphasis has moved from U.S. hegemony to more of a global realignment in which America played a leading role and worked in partnership with countries like Prussia and Turkey. Could I get your opinion on what's precipitated Mr. Brzezinski's course correction?
Well, his policies that he enunciated in the grand chessboard have failed. They have led to the opposite results. Remember, in the grand chessboard, he talked about the encirclement of the U.S.-Eurasian opponents and by essentially controlling what Nicholas Spykman called the Rimland, controlling the countries from the Black Sea in the west to the Sea of Japan in the east, and in this way encircling the U.S. opponents and Eurasia, primarily Russia, but also China. However, you know, so in line with these policies, the U.S. has implemented two invasions in the region, first the invasion of Afghanistan together with NATO, and then the invasion of Iraq. However, these invasions led to the opposite results. They were unsuccessful. They were unsuccessful in attaining the aims posited by Brzezinski. In fact, instead of making the United States more globally powerful and underscoring its global primacy that Brzezinski talked about, these interventions have done the opposite. And in fact, they have accelerated the emergence of a multipolar world. And I think this has to do something with the policies that Brzezinski promoted. You know, he promoted the policies of nationalism. You know, his grand idea about breaking up the Soviet Union, which turned out to be successful, was to promote national self-determination of many, many peoples who lived under the Soviet Union. However, this is the genie that once you get out of the bottle, it can turn against you. You know, it's a force that cannot be controlled because it's essentially anti-imperial force. You know, you cannot use nationalism to impose another imperialism. And this was Brzezinski's biggest mistake. And this is why in his last book published 5 years ago, Strategic Vision, you don't have the geopolitical confidence that he expressed and articulated in his earlier books. This geopolitical confidence has evaporated because his imperial dreams of the U.S. dominant role in Eurasia have been shattered. And in fact, what's happening right now is that even his idea of the West is being shattered. So not only did the U.S. not gain global primacy, it is even losing the dominant role in the West. Let alone controlling the East and Russia as well. So what we have essentially is a strategic failure. We have a vision that could not sustain itself. That many people have said that once you start this destroying, you know, social and political stability, this kind of virus of instability is going to spread far and wide. And in fact, at this point of time, I think it has also come to the North American continent and to the United States.
I'm going to just quote from an article he wrote about a year ago. And this is in theamericaninterest.com. He writes, "In today's post-colonial world, a new historical narrative is emerging. A profound resentment against the West and its colonial legacy in Muslim countries and beyond is being used to justify their sense of deprivation and denial of self-dignity." And then he says, "Given all this, a long and painful road toward an initially limited regional accommodation is the only viable option for the United States, Russia, China, and the pertinent Middle Eastern entities. For the United States, that will require patient persistence in forging cooperative relationships with some new partners, particularly Russia and China, as well as joint efforts with more established and historically rooted Muslim states, namely Turkey, Iran, Egypt,
and Saudi Arabia if it can detach its foreign policy from Wahhabi extremism in shaping a wider framework of regional stability. So I just wanted to get your thoughts about you particularly not only that realignment, but the specific centers that he mentions.
Well, it may be too late for that, you know, because what we are seeing in Eurasia at this point of time is the possible alliance between two great powers of Russia and China. And here I would like to point out to the work of the Shanghai Cooperation Organization, which was set up under the Russian and Chinese leadership in 2001, and which has so far accepted as members India, Pakistan, and Iran. And this is exactly something that Dzerzhinsky described 20 years ago in his book, The Grand Chessboard, as the worst case scenario. This is the worst case scenario. In addition to that, we have Russia that has rejuvenated its focus on the what they call the near abroad, the former republics of the Soviet Union. So and here we see two major regional organizations. We see the Collective Security Treaty Organization, which is essentially the Russian equivalent of NATO. And we also see the Eurasian Economic Union, which has the ambition of becoming some kind of a EU type project for Eurasia. So Dzerzhinsky is right. This is being fueled by the resentment of the West. But he, you know, he is responsible for this resentment. I mean, he doesn't want to recognize his own role in building up the reaction from the other side. I mean, why didn't he talk about this realignment in the 1990s? No, at the time he wanted to take advantage of the breakup of the Soviet Union and at the time the Chinese-Russian disagreement, because he wanted to expand the U.S. as the U.S. power as the global hegemon and to strengthen it. And so in other words, it sounds to me like the sour grape. He's saying, well, we cannot reach it. The fox is looking at the grape saying, oh, I cannot reach it. So it's sour. It's sour anyway. I don't need it. I think that Dzerzhinsky should have been much more honest about his role in inciting the resentment. And in fact, we are stuck with that. You know, we are stuck with the results of his failed strategic advices to the U.S. policymakers, especially to the Clinton administration, which strongly pushed for the expansion of NATO into Eastern Europe and the former Soviet Union. This is exactly what Dzerzhinsky wanted, in contrast to Kissinger, who from the beginning wanted to rely on some kind of détente, of some kind of a strategic cooperation among the great powers.
But there also, like in implicit in Brzezinski's miscalculation, this idea that by trying to socially engineer these popular movements, that he simply underestimated the extent to which these popular movements just take on a lives of their own or spark other popular movements that you just can't control or confine them, and that's leading to
yes, definitely. I mean, he Dzerzhinsky coined the concept of the Eurasian Balkans, having been known as the region full of historical, religious, and cultural animosities, and essentially he projected this idea of the Balkans into Eurasia. But he forgot that he did not want to mention that in Eurasia there are hundreds and hundreds of different ethnicities that could rise against the central powers, and that if they all did rise against the central authorities and in the various capitals, this would lead to some kind of the new Middle Ages in Eurasia, including violence and instability and the breakup of all economic and cultural ties. So in essence, you know, instead of helping out the work of let's say legitimate authorities, His policies were aimed at subversion of those authorities, but this is not something you can stop. It's like the genie, once it gets out of the bottle, it's extremely difficult to put it back. This is exactly what we are seeing. So Brzezinski has left us with a much more unstable world. He and other policymakers had a chance in the 1990s, I think, to develop a vision for a different world, for a world where the victors would not take the advantage of the defeated, of the vanquished, and he did not go for it. I don't know whether this was the animosity he felt against the Soviet Union that really was an important motive in all his work, whether this was some kind of a Russophobic feeling that he had as somebody who was of Polish descent. His strategic advice was good for destruction, but it was not good for creation. And I think this is one of his biggest legacies, is that he knew how to destroy, how to break up, but he did not know how to build up and construct.
I had one more question for you. The people that seem to be leading the charge these days in the United States, the neocons, they are more committed to the grand chessboard vision, I would guess, than they are to the more recent strategic vision, Brzezinski. So where do you see things moving forward? Do you see that the path of destruction is just going to continue to unravel, or will there be a reckoning at some point?
I know this is foolish and it is devious. I mean, the vision elaborated in the grand chessboard has been proven to be unsustainable and also very much damaging to the U.S. interest. So I think whoever insists on this vision is pushing the U.S. into some kind of a global confrontation, into some kind of a World War III against the great Eurasian powers, which the United States cannot win. And so I think it's essentially deadly to go down this way. And by the way, I mean, the very title of the book is a misnomer, as the controversial Russian professor of geopolitics, Alexander Dugin, pointed out. For chess, you need two people to play. And so Brzezinski did not talk about chess. He talked about some kind of one-person game that he wanted the United States to play with the rest of the world. And it's also interesting that Brzezinski admitted that he fooled Gorbachev. Dugin reports his conversation with Brzezinski that took place in Washington, D.C. in the 1990s, where Brzezinski said, he admitted, we have tricked Gorbachev. So in essence, you cannot, if you have from the very beginning, if you have some kind of a trickery and deception, you cannot expect the other side not to use the same type of strategy once they have a chance. And I think Russia and China now have a pretty good chance of using some kind of trickery and deception against the United States.
Okay. Well, with that, I think we'll leave it there. Professor Filip Kovacevic, I want to really thank you for sharing your thoughts with us.
Thank you very much.
We've been speaking with geopolitical author and university professor Filip Kovacevic. He teaches at the University of San Francisco and functions as senior analyst for Russia and the Balkans for Newsbud.com.
You've been listening to the Global Research News Hour. You can listen to our programs every week on CKUW 95.9 FM in Winnipeg and on partnering radio stations across Canada and the United States. We are now also broadcast on the Progressive Radio Network at PRN.fm. You can also download each episode from the website globalresearch.ca. To leave feedback on this program, email globalresearchnewshour@gmail.com. I'm series host, creator, and producer Michael Welch. Join us again next week.